on WNYC. And as you may know, Mockingjay hit bookstores on Tuesday, the final novel in the Hunger Games trilogy by Suzanne Collins. If you don't already know, that's the dystopian young adult series that booksellers expect to sell big. The series is part of a larger trend of super popular serialized young adult fiction. Twilight, Harry Potter, Percy Jackson. So in our fourth and final segment on books and the future of the publishing industry, we're going to talk about why the young adult book market is blowing up, why adults get into it, and where YA fiction is headed. Michael Cater, the founder of Publishers Marketplace and the widely read daily newsletter for the publishing industry, Publishers Lunch, has joined us each week this month, and he's here for one final time. Hey, Michael, and thanks for doing this great series with us.
Sure, it's been fun. I'm glad to be back.
So a bright spot in book publishing. Eager readers lining up at midnight on Tuesday for the release of Mockingjay. And for those who don't know, what is the Hunger Games series?
Well, you pretty much gave it a good description. It is a three-book series of dystopian fiction, so it's set in a troubled future. Suzanne Collins used to be sort of a pure young adult writer. Before the Hunger Games trilogy, she had written a series of books about a character called Gregor the Overlander. And then she developed this series, which, as you said, has caught fire both among young readers but also among adult readers. Last year, Stephen King was among those who gave the book a big plug. And adult readers have been looking forward to the new book as eagerly as some of her teen fans.
And listeners, we want to put together a reading list during this segment for young adults, which really for the most part means teenagers, as the market is actually defined, but we know everybody's reading them. So channel your teenage self and send in a few recommendations for young adults. Maybe you're a parent of somebody who's reading these books. Maybe you're reading them yourselves. Or whatever, 212-433. They can be nonfiction books as well. There are those in that category of young adult, too. And we have a list already taking shape on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show or call us up on the air with your suggestions for young adult books, fiction or nonfiction, in the last couple of weeks before school starts up again. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or populate that comments page at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Michael, these are dark books, the Hunger Games trilogy. And in fact, much of the young adult fiction is dystopian and dark, isn't it?
A lot of these books are dark, you're right. It's either dystopian, another big wave is what's called steampunk fiction, which is sort of a different variant on sci-fi or speculative fiction.
Steampunk?
Steampunk. They're technically set in the Victorian era, although at the same time they launch forward into a kind of sci-fi effects. Paranormals are also big. You talked about Twilight. You know, among YA books, it's not only vampires, but shapeshifters and ghosts and time travel and all kinds of otherworldly creatures with special powers that attract a lot of interest. I think it's clear that for kids, a lot of these books are escapist or allow them to play out some of the issues and darker impulses that they're reckoning with through the pages of fiction, although it wasn't too long ago that parents and some critics were complaining that all teen fiction was just oversex books about teenage girls in high school. So I think we have to be careful about not being too judgmental about what kids are reading and recognize that they're reading more, they're reading a lot, and a lot of really good, interesting talent is emerging, and a lot of adult writers are also being attracted to write for kids.
And I can tell you, as the parent of a 12-year-old, that it's an active discussion among parents as to the darkness of a lot of young adult fiction and whether this is really what kids need to process adolescence, or whether they're just being, you know, manipulated by the authors and by the publishing industry into reading this stuff that might actually make them feel worse when they could be reading things that are more uplifting and make them feel better.
Well, you know, as a parent, it's pretty hard to get a kid to read anything they don't want to read. So I think the fact that there's a body of literature out there that kids like to read should be encouraging for most of us. You know, even the annual awards are often given to very dark books, and
yes,
every time that's awarded, there's a new discussion among parents and librarians
Absolutely.
And teachers. I think the fact that we're discussing it is good, because that's the other great thing, is that kids actually do like to talk about these books. It's not something they slink off to their room and you never hear from them again, or that they talk to each other about the books as well.
Jennifer on our Facebook page writes, "Why vampires? Vampires are powerful outsiders. Perfectly captures the angst of not belonging and the compensatory pride of not belonging that defines a lot of the young adult experience." Rebecca in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rebecca. You got a book?
Oh, yeah. I recently read Summerlands by Michael Chabon, and I didn't realize when I picked it up it was sort of directed at young adults or even, you
Give
know.
Me your six-word blurb for Summerland.
Oh, exciting fantasy involving the theme of baseball and interdimensional travel to rescue his lost father.
Nice. Thank you very much. Ted in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. You got a book?
Yeah, it's actually the series, the vampire series that has New Moon and Eclipse in it. I guess it's a four-book series. My 10-year-old daughter is reading it.
That is the Twilight series, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Twilight, correct. I'm sorry.
Go
we
ahead.
We were worried that it had maybe strong sexual content or something of that nature, but it doesn't. It has a lot of imagination, but there's no explicit or gratuitous content. So we were happy to have her read it, and my wife as well are very excited to read it and can't put it down. So.
Well, and in fact, the author, Stephanie Meyer, is a Mormon, and so the books are, in fact, all about the sex that doesn't happen and the romance.
Ted, thank you very much. Listeners, what else you got to recommend for the last 2 weeks of school for the young adult readers? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for Michael Cater from Publisher's Lunch. Michael, why do they call the genre young adult? In the rest of the world, young adult means 18 to 34. In publishing, it seems to mean like 12 to 18.
Well, I think in some ways young adult is actually a holdover. If you look in stores, they're starting to break out what they are now calling teen sections, which is perhaps more appropriate. There are a variety of categories in children's book publishing that used to have more to do with signaling to parents or teachers or librarians what the appropriate age bracket might be. And now, of course, our ideas of what those age brackets has changed, and a lot of this quote-unquote teen fiction sometimes appeals to true young adults, and even sometimes older adults, whether the mothers or fathers. So, as I said, if you walk into a store, what we're now seeing, in fact, is the big chains, as they take space away from music and DVDs, are giving it over to these expanding teen book sections.
How do you explain the appeal for adults?
I think they are enjoying some of the escapism that one of your readers just talked about. I think, as I said, these books are attracting really good writers. They're often shorter, although not necessarily. They're often a little less expensive. So, you know, the hardcover of the new Suzanne Collins, I think, is priced at $17.99. The Stephanie Meyer books were priced lower than traditional hardcover frontlist adult releases. So there's good value there, too.
Yeah.
I think some parents want to read what their kids are reading. James Patterson has done a number of technically YA series, but some people think they're pitched as much towards his general readership as his young readership.
And I guess that's the next trick, right, is trying to capture both markets at the same time on purpose.
Exactly. And I think publishers and readers alike realize that there was a time there where you really jumped from pure kids' books to only having adult books available. And we were losing readers, and we were teaching kids to be not so interested in reading. And I think everyone responded to the idea that there really ought to be some kind of body of literature out there for kids of these in-between ages, and that if you provided good books, the readers wouldn't go away, that they'd pick up the books and they'd keep reading, and maybe we'd keep them as readers on into adulthood.
All right. Chris in Hazlitt has a young adult series to recommend. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is it?
It's called Chains. It's Chains, and it's a historic novel that parallels a young slave girl's journey for her own personal freedom with the Revolutionary War and our country's fight for freedom from the British. And it's just an amazing read, and it is part of a trilogy from what I understand.
Chris, thank you very much. And Michael, there's a lot of great historical fiction. What a wonderful genre in general, in my opinion. Is that very popular right now? Because you can actually teach history through telling a story, you know, in a way that will make kids interested in history like history books often don't.
There's a lot of good material out there. I think of the newer series that are catching fire, some may be set in a historical time. I think probably not. There are not that many that jump to mind that we would classify as pure historical fiction.
Mm-hmm. Malcolm in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Malcolm.
Hey, what's up? I'm Malcolm, and I'm 14 years old, and like, you're kind of leading into what you guys were talking about, how kids are reading darker fiction. Me and my friends over the summer were reading, like, Neil Gaiman, Fahrenheit 451, and it seems like those are nothing compared to everything that's out today. Like, I've read The Hunger Games and all that, and those are all, they have, like, multiple plot holes and everything, and it seems like, basically, you can't really define young adult fiction. It's all about the maturity level, and you know what I mean? It's,
Are you looking for something that's not out there?
How dark it is.
Yeah, and so are you looking for something that's not out there? Ideally, you want to get away from a little of this darkness.
Well, I mean, no, it's not that. I the thing is, me and my friends love like reading dark stuff. I mean, I guess maybe we're like stereotypical young adult readers these days. But I mean, we really like dark stuff, and sometimes you guys were talking about how dark the fiction is getting. But to read like darker fantasy stuff that's really imaginative, mm-hmm. sometimes we have to look outside of the market for young adult readers. And so, by those terms, I think like something that's a young adult, it's really hard to define because it's really based on the maturity level of the reader.
Malcolm, great call. Thank you very much. Sounds like his maturity level is really high. The nonfiction trade book market is huge. That's adult nonfiction. But there doesn't seem to be much of a market for nonfiction young adult books. Is there?
There's distinctly less nonfiction, at least in what we'd consider pleasure reading for kids. Again, in recent years, we have seen some narrative nonfiction adult bestsellers will often get adapted into YA versions. So right now, the book Three Cups of Tea, that's been a huge seller in paperback for years on the adult side, has come out in a YA version. There was a great book about the hunt for John Wilkes Booth called Manhunt that was sort of rewritten into a YA version. I think it's often when the books might figure into a curriculum somewhere or have some support beyond pure pleasure reading that mm-hmm. you'll see those transformations of an adult book into a YA version.
Three Cups of Tea about setting up schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So finally, an update. We talked about the future of bookstores in the first segment of this month-long series with you. Just after Barnes & Noble announced it was putting itself up for sale, this week they posted way worse than expected quarterly sales. So give me the latest on the sale of Barnes & Noble in our last minute or so.
Actually, their sales weren't bad. It's their profits that declined more than people were expecting,
okay.
In part because they had to spend $10 million to fight this proxy battle. The news underneath the hood was they're still selling a fair amount of books, and they're selling more e-books than before. This is probably going to be a battle that will last through September. But the stores themselves appear to still be healthy, and I think customers will still have Barnes & Noble stores around in some form. It's just going to depend on who's owning them and who's running them and whether they're changing very much.
Len Riggio, B&N founder, and his nemesis, billionaire Ron Burkle, are still fighting over ownership?
They're still fighting. There's an annual meeting scheduled for September 28th when they're going to each try to obtain votes on their own slates of directors for the board. And the battle could go well beyond then if they don't come up with a decision about how to make peace or find a buyer for the company or if one of the two doesn't decide to buy the other out.
Michael Cater, the founder of Publishers Marketplace and the widely read daily newsletter for the publishing industry, Publishers Lunch. Thanks again so much for this series every Thursday in August. It's been really informative. We have so many readers in our listenership who've really appreciated this and a lot of fun, too. So thanks again, Michael.
Sure. It's great to talk about books with people.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.